Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
Remember this.
Vinyl fencing torn apart like children's toys. Over there in the distance, you see that the roof was ripped off that building. And over here, among all these downed trees...
It's been a month since an unusually severe thunderstorm barreled through South Jersey. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The damage was widespread, as described in that clip from 6ABC. But what affected many most were the power outages, which dragged on for a week for some. The New Jersey Board of Public Utilities now has a report card on how the power companies responded. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Atlantic City Electric saw the most outages in New Jersey. More than 260,000 people lost power. That's more than half of all AC Electric customers. The Board of Public Utilities says the power company did not communicate well with customers, local officials, or the BPU in the early hours after the storm. It says Atlantic City Electric lacked, quote, situational awareness. That said, the BPU did note the sheer strength of the storm and the extensive damage it caused. Vince Mayone, region president for Atlantic City Electric, said that intensity caught them by surprise.
This one became an incredibly fierce storm that we probably received about an hour notice before it significantly impacted the area. We still had our line personnel in place, but we didn't anticipate the enormity of this event.
But others criticized the utility for not preparing well enough ahead of time. Lou Manzo is president of the Gloucester County Mayor's Association.
We're out of power. We got severity as far as poles down and substations and all that, but you should have a plan for that, even if it's not going to happen maybe once every 100 years. And I think they could have been better prepared. I think they would say that, too.
PSE&G was the other New Jersey electric utility heavily affected by last month's storm, though it took less damage than Atlantic City Electric. The BPU says PSE&G did more before the storm and applauded the utility for sending out staff ahead of time. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Congress wants to crack down on cities like Philadelphia that protect undocumented immigrants by limiting their cooperation with federal immigration officials. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that the House of Representatives has passed a bill that would cut Justice Department law enforcement funding to so-called sanctuary cities.
The crackdown comes after a 32-year-old woman was gunned down in San Francisco on July 1st, allegedly by an undocumented immigrant with a criminal record. The bill now heads to the Senate, and President Obama is already vowing to veto it. Republican Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey did not respond to requests for comment, but expressed support for curbing sanctuary cities on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT earlier this month.
I don't think this is defensible policy.
Philadelphia does not consider itself to be a sanctuary city, but House Republicans appear to be using the term loosely to refer to cities that defy federal immigration authorities. Last year, Mayor Michael Nutter signed an executive order that the city will not keep immigrants in police custody at the request of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Erica Almiron heads Juntos, a Latino advocacy group that urged Nutter to sign the order because of fears in the community.
People not coming out of their houses, people who were not speaking to police if they ever saw something.
Almiron says the relationship between Latino immigrants and the police in Philadelphia has since improved. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Across the board, Philadelphia students who go to small high schools are more likely to pass Algebra 1 and less likely to get suspended. But not all small schools are created equal. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that the school district's decision to fix two low-achieving small schools by combining them has raised questions among students and teachers.
In the old Kensington High School building, there are two distinct schools with their own budgets, principals, and classes. There's even a wall dividing the two spaces.
There somewhat is a wall, but it's like doors separating it.
Essence Whiting is a rising sophomore at one of the schools, Kensington Urban Education Academy, which has just over 300 students. She says she prefers the small neighborhood school to the middle school she went to, where the grades were three times the size.
I know most of the teachers at my current school, and I know the principal. I know the secretaries and all that. I know some of the lunch ladies. I can go there and like walk up to somebody and be like, hey. And they'll be like, hey, Essence, I know you too.
Community and activist groups lobbied for a decade to turn some of Philadelphia's large neighborhood high schools, including Kensington, into smaller schools. That's because neighborhood schools in big cities face more challenges, says Senior Associate with Research for Action, Rebecca Ruman Moore. These include more students in poverty and with special needs.
So generally, their outcomes and their graduation rates are relatively low.
In 2008, activists got their wish. Kensington High became four small schools, each with a different academic focus. Two of the schools, Kensington Creative and Performing Arts and Kensington Health Sciences, flourished. But this past March, school district officials announced they would merge the other two schools, Kensington Urban Education Academy and Kensington International Business.
Hello, members of the School Reform Commission.
That's gotten students like Mark Anthony Moreno worked up.
I am a youth leader with Youth United for Change. Don't close our schools or put them together.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
He and Nadia Watson came to the School Reform Commission meeting to plead for their school. Watson says replacing the old mega school was a definite improvement. But to succeed, she says those schools needed more support.
I know Kensington Urban hasn't been the best school. You have to realize where Kensington Urban has started from. Y'all didn't give Urban the resources they needed to be a successful school.
Here lies the chicken and the egg conundrum for small neighborhood schools in Philadelphia. District officials like Assistant Superintendent Cheryl Logan say part of the reason schools like Urban fail is because they aren't competitive. Their brand doesn't attract many students and not the high-achieving ones.
If we didn't place kids in that school, there would not be kids in that school.
But students say even low-performing small schools have their benefits, and they could attract more students with the right supports. The small schools with the most dramatic results tend to have strong leaders, which the district selects, and an attractive focus. That's the case for the two Kensington schools that perform relatively well. While Urban's principal was one of three fired in 2014 because of the district's cheating scandal. To add to the complexity, research on small schools in Philadelphia is sparse, according to Ruman Moore. But there are encouraging signs from New York City, where small schools saw a big jump in graduation rates and college enrollment.
The findings were quite striking, and it's especially striking that these are schools that serve mostly disadvantaged students of color, and we're seeing very positive results.
But in Philadelphia, when small schools were no longer the flavor of the month, research dollars dried up. Now there are all kinds of small schools, from charters to magnets, and it's hard to compare results. In Kensington, district officials hope merging the schools will help them hold on to what's been working at Kensington Business, namely career and technical classes, and get a clean slate otherwise. But student Essence Whiting says she's worried the merger is only the first step towards closure, which was the district's other option.
I feel like they would close it down for reasons of test scores, possibly, because one side has lower test scores than the other, and merging them together is going to bring the average down. And then the kids have nowhere to go.
Bowing to pressure from students like Essence and activist group Youth United for Change, Superintendent William Height sent a letter to families saying the merger's postponed for another year. Kind of. Starting in the fall, both schools will share a principal and some joint classes. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is criticizing Amtrak for the electrical power problems that caused delays for 4 days this week. He's urging Congress to get involved and says he's asked the state attorney general's office to see what can be done. Protecting workers in New Jersey nail salons is the intent of two Republican state senators whose bill would mandate random inspections of salons, which would be required to have proper ventilation. Workers will be required to wear gloves, face masks, and goggles when working with dangerous substances such as formaldehyde and acetone-based nail polish removers. 84 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clear skies overnight, low 68 degrees, sunny tomorrow, high 88. Sunday, partly sunny with a 40% chance of late-day scattered showers or storms, high 90. Still ahead, let's go back in time and attend a baseball game as it was played in Civil War days.
This is probably as close as the way that they played back in the 1860s as possible, because we're playing on an actual sheep pasture, and I think he's cleared the sheep already.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and invites you to dive into art this summer at the Barnes with unrivaled masterpieces from Renoir, Matisse, Picasso, Cezanne, and Van Gogh, plus African sculpture, metalwork, and more, featuring tours, workshops, live music on First Fridays, and programs for the whole family, plus a contemporary exhibition, Mark Dion, Judy Pfaff, Fred Wilson, The Order of Things, in its final days through August 3rd. Tickets at the door or at barnesfoundation.org.
I listen to Bullseye because I want to feel as passionately about things that I love as Jesse Thorne does. And his shows just become essential to me. Just can't imagine not listening.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Liz Garbus about her new documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone, on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Rachel Giza. Old Man Ludica is a beloved banjo king from Chester, Nova Scotia. His new album, Domestic Eccentric, is based on his experience of new fatherhood. Next time on Q, he talks about that inspiration and performs live in studio. That's coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
Get more interesting. Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The U.S. and Cuba take the next step to mending fences with the reopening of their embassies this week. Let's gauge public attitudes on the thaw following a 50-year-long chill with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hi, hello, Dave.
Frank, critics of restoring relations, and there are many, are quite vocal. But are they in the majority?
They are not. The American public, when asked, say yes, it's a good idea. And Americans have a much more favorable opinion of Cuba than has been the case in the past. When we last updated it this spring in our annual update of Americans' images of foreign countries, it was 46% with a favorable opinion of Cuba, 48% unfavorable. That's highly unusual. Using this format going all the way back to the 90s, it's always been a much higher net negative. For example, back in 1996, 81% of Americans had an unfavorable opinion.
Hey, Frank, is there a dominant dog days of summer dilemma facing the nation today?
Often throughout history, there is one problem that dominates. Back in 08, for example, it was the economy, the huge recession that hit us, plus underneath that, the Iraq War. But right now, we are at a period of time when there is no one dominant problem. In fact, the highest single problem Americans mention this month, July, is the economy in general, and that's only 13%. Another 13% say dissatisfaction with government in general. And then below that, we have a slight uptick in Americans who say race issues are the top problem facing the country. That's 9%. Then immigration, the federal deficit, and things like that, but at much lower percents.
And as it is so often the economy cited as the number one problem, is this perhaps a ratification that folks feel the economy is doing a bit better?
Well, we have many measures of that. Our economic confidence measure, our consumer confidence measure, actually has shown a decline recently rather than an uptick. So we're not seeing as much of an ebullient attitude about the economy on that measure. So I would say from the perceptual perspective of the American public, it's a mixed bag about how they see the economy at this point.
Another mixed bag. The Supreme Court issued decisions earlier this summer on two divisive issues, the Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage. And Frank, have those rulings shifted Americans' views of the court?
They did indeed. In fact, 76% of Democrats right now say they have a favorable image. They approve of the job the Supreme Court's doing. That's the highest percent from Democrats in history. We have only 18% of Republicans who say they approve, and that is the lowest approval among Republicans in history. Dave, it reminds me of what we see when we ask about the presidency. The Supreme Court supposedly is nonpartisan, but at this point in history, Americans more than ever are really viewing it through partisan lenses.
Does Gallup ask respondents to focus on specific court members, particularly Chief Justice John Roberts?
Indeed, we do. Now, you remember your history. Roberts was appointed by a Republican, George W. Bush. He was considered to be a conservative appointee. And initially, Republicans were more positive than Democrats. That has flipped now in our most recent update after these recent decisions. 37% of Democrats have a favorable opinion of Roberts, 23% of Republicans. So that's a 14-point gap. He's more liked by Democrats than Republicans, even though he is a Republican-appointed nominee for the Supreme Court. So clearly, John Roberts has fallen out of favor with conservatives and with Republicans.
Anthony Kennedy was also appointed by a Republican, Ronald Reagan, back in 88, and he was considered the swing vote on the same-sex marriage decision. Are respondents weighing in on him as well?
They do, and it's the same profile as John Roberts. For Kennedy, 36% approve among Democrats, 18% among Republicans. He's clearly more cheered on now by Democrats than Republicans. Keep in mind, a lot of Americans don't have opinions on either of these justices, Roberts or Kennedy, but the data clearly show people are paying attention to some extent.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Vintage baseball teams take to farm fields and pastures to recreate the game as it was played 150 years ago. WHYY's John Abbott takes us back to the time of a gentlemanly game when Abraham Lincoln was president.
It's a great Saturday afternoon for baseball. A capacity crowd of 50 fills the three rows of bleachers on either side of home plate as the Neshanics of Flemington, New Jersey are hosting a doubleheader against the Eclipse of Elkton, Maryland. Some 40 players in heavy cotton uniforms, replicas of baseball's earliest days, are warming up by playing catch barehanded. Umpire Sam Bernstein, in his formal black suit, top hat, and carrying a silver-handled walking stick, checks his pocket watch, then addresses the fans.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our contest today. We are playing with 1864 rules. You will notice that the rules are very similar, but there are some differences. Ladies and gentlemen, I also want to let you know that we are still at war, and I send out our prayers to Abraham Lincoln, our President of the United States, and hopefully that he will bring our union back together again. Thank you and enjoy the game.
In the mid-19th century, baseball was played in pastures and on whatever open land was available. Brad Brooklyn Shaw, player-manager of the Neshanics, is leading a team through a home game at the Howell Living History Farm in Lambertville, New Jersey.
This is probably as close as the way that they played back in the 1860s as possible, because we're playing on an actual sheep pasture. And I think he's cleared the sheep already. We had a little concern there about running in the outfield with sheep.
Baseball was considered a gentleman's game back then. Players comported themselves much more conservatively. If they used foul language, umpires could fine players a nickel or even a dime. Those were hefty amounts in 1864. But Shaw says the largest difference is the one-bounce rule for flying out.
You can catch the ball on one bounce for an out. But every time somebody does try to catch the ball on one bounce, if he can catch it on a fly, I am going to yell unmanly, because any boy of five can catch the ball on a bounce. So you should be trying to catch the ball on a fly.
Another difference is a ball is in play even if there's a natural obstacle. In this case, a large fallen tree in short right field. They nicknamed it the Green Monster. If a ball is hit into the tree, it's pretty much played as is. Umpire Sam Bernstein explains how he'd call the play.
If it hits the tree and it's caught on a bound, we're going to say that it's an out. If it goes into the tree and we lose sight of the ball, I'm probably going to give the base to the player. Probably one base.
Shaw says the Neshanic roster includes executives, a retiree, a multimedia editor, a chiropractor, and a former newspaper reporter. The Vintage League teams play exhibition games throughout the Mid-Atlantic. Walk-on players are welcome, and teams often have extra uniforms to lend. On this day, 1950s Baltimore Orioles right-hander Ron Herrion was in the crowd.
This is amazing. I wish it was advertised more, so more people get out here and see what baseball really started as.
Even though decades before Jackie Robinson, the era these teams recreate was racially integrated. Segregation came in the 1880s when baseball owners voted to prohibit signing African-American players. But before then, highly regarded black players did not have to sign with so-called Negro League teams. There were even cases of women concealing their gender for a chance to play in the 1860s. Bruce Leith, player-manager of the Elkton Eclipse, has a day job as concessions development manager for the Phillies. He says anyone who attends a game will immediately recognize it as baseball.
There's a lot of quirks that make it really great, and it's a great sport that shows people what the at the beginning of baseball, what it was like before million-dollar contracts, automobiles, televisions, steroids, and gloves.
With no warm-ups or commercial breaks, the vintage games are much quicker. On this day, a doubleheader took only 3 hours. In Lambertville, New Jersey, and riding the bench, I'm John Abbott, WHYY News.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
We need a hit, so here I go.
Ball one.
Yay!
Ball two.
Yay!
Finally this evening, in the things that go bump in the night department, you may have come across this bizarre news item this week. After hearing noises in a spare bedroom, a Middlesex County, New Jersey homeowner investigated and found a stranger hiding under his spare bed back in May. Jason Hubbard was apparently hiding there for 3 days and was using an outlet to charge 4 cell phones. He was arrested, charged with criminal trespass, burglary, and theft of electricity. A little creepy. But check this out. In September 2012, a woman in Rock Hill, South Carolina, discovered her ex-boyfriend living in her attic, where he'd apparently been for 2 weeks after his jail release. He was originally convicted of stealing her car. In 2013, a group of Ohio State students discovered another student living in a locked room in their basement, which they previously believed to be a utility closet. It was actually a fully furnished room with hung pictures, a sink, and a toilet. Well, after changing the locks, the student returned and apparently asked if he could pick up his stuff. Though it's tough to top this one. In 2008, a man in Kasuya, Japan, caught an intruder on a surveillance camera. When police investigated, they found a homeless woman who'd apparently been living on a top shelf of a closet for a year. She said she came down, ate, and showered when the man was out.
There's a monster under my bed, oh no. Is he real or in my head? I don't know. I just want to go to sleep, but I can't help but feel that he's coming.
On that terrifying note, we bring the curtain down on tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from our intern, Maggie Freeling. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Diana Martinez. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. Chris Satullo is WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
There's a monster under my bed, oh no. Is he real or in my head? I don't know. I just want to go to sleep, but I can't help but feel that he's coming for me.
Inglis celebrates the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the fundamental civil rights it ensures. Founded in 1877, Inglis is proud to support those who, in the true spirit of the ADA, are redefining ability and independence every day. For information about independent housing, employment services, adapted technology, and more, the website is Inglis.org. That's I-N-G-L-I-S.org. Inglis proudly supports WHYY.